It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy Iannocco and Renee Richey are here. Where is that Mac Mini anyway? We'll ask that question. We'll also talk about Johnny Ive. He's consolidating his power in the front office. And would you pay $1,000 for an iWatch? Let's talk about it next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 398, recorded April 15th, 2014. The Police Pursuit Package. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Nature Box, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like whole wheat figgy bars. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 30 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative project to the next level. For 20% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code MACBREAK414. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover all your Apple stuff. And kind of a dearth of stories this week, so it's going to be rumor central. And I'll warn you up front, there might be a little bit of mention of something of other products from other companies. I hope you can handle that. Andy Iannocco is here. He might talk about comic books. I can't promise he won't. He's from the Chicago Sun-Times. Back from Boulder,
where I don't want to say I was disappointed that I didn't see quite so many people quite as high as I expected them to be. But if this is the difference between like a state in which marijuana could be simply bought by anybody who's an adult and not, is it just that everybody in Massachusetts is high all the time and I haven't noticed it? I really was looking forward to like walking down the street and saying, walking into a store and saying, okay, I can buy Tic Tacs, People Magazine, last week's Cosmo, a Zagnut bar, and some pot.
Purple Kush, please.
Yes, I don't partake, but I was looking forward to that sort of dissonance, like where, wait a minute, this is supposed to be very, very illegal, and I'm supposed to be putting myself in danger somehow, but legally by buying this.
Were they selling? Because it's legal in Boulder. So were they selling it in the stores?
No, not that I was able to see. But then again, I wasn't off campus all that much. But like driving around, I was expecting. I guess I didn't know what I was expecting to see.
Henry told me it hasn't changed. My son is a student, yeah, of course, at Colorado University of Colorado Boulder, where Andy just was for the Council of World Affairs. And he told me, oh, no, you can't. It's not like to the point where you still have to go to the dispensaries and stuff.
Yeah, and I was told by a couple of locals that not a whole lot has changed because everybody still knows somebody who has a grow in the basement, and it's a lot cheaper to buy from your usual source. So why not buy it from the usual source?
This is an unexpected consequence of legalization of marijuana. Anyway, before we talk more about Council of World Affairs, let's say welcome Renee Richey, also from iMore.com. Hello, Renee. Good to see you.
Good, Leo. I don't want to get in the way of Andy's pot talk, so I'll just say a quick hello.
Is pot legal in Montreal? Feels like it should be.
It's decriminalized.
I know sex is legal there.
Everything is legal here, starting at the age of 18, Leo.
Yeah. As long as you're of age, you can do anything you damn well please. It's just a very French outlook on life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Henry said it's nothing's changed. People still mostly get drunk. Yeah. Alcohol is still the preferred.
It'll get you to the finish line, only without quite so much of a stink.
Yeah. So you had fun at the Council on World Affairs. What is the Council on World Affairs? You go every year, I know, and you talk about this every year.
Yeah, basically, it's for every year for the past like 40 years, the University of Colorado gets together about 100 people from all kinds of disciplines and to talk about panels about something like 20 a day that are open to the public on every issue you can imagine. So I'm part of the science and technology track. So they usually put me on things like, you know, on things like, you know, web 3.0 and things about what Snowden was up to, the maker movement. Although it's a really diverse group. I was on a panel about comics with G. Willow Wilson, who created that really great Ms. Marvel comic, and a couple other guys. I was on a panel on lying.
Oh,
John Roderick and a couple others. I shared it. But the what I love about this conference is that it really is like the X Games half pipe snowboarding competition, only intellectually speaking.
Yeah.
Where you can't really prepare a 12-minute talk about each of these topics. What you do is you create them. You know that I'm going to start at this point. I'm going to end at this point. I'm going to try to do these three things in there. And at any point, I could land on my head and basically humiliate myself in a really terrible way. But the people that you meet there, like I have some of my best friends I've met at this conference over the past 10 or 15 years. And I mean, even on the ride back to the airport, being driven in a minivan by a student, sharing a van with somebody who was assistant director of science communications at NASA, Goddard. And she was telling me things about pulsars that kind of freaked me out a little bit, because I didn't know that, how can they be generating more mass within themselves if they're doing this? And so I wound up having to furiously like download stuff onto my iPad so I could read it on the plane. So there, a week doesn't go by where I don't feel like I've learned something really, really cool, met some cool people, and realized exactly how inadequate my own curriculum vitae is.
But what fun, huh?
It's a lot of fun.
It's so cool.
The fact that you pay your own way to go there, and so many of these speakers keep coming back year after year, just shows you what a cool event it is.
Yeah. Well, we're glad to have you back, and glad you had a good time. Thank goodness Sir Johnny Ive is kept busy, because if it weren't for him, I don't know if we'd have any Apple news at all. What is it going on, Renee? We're waiting for the other shoe to drop, I guess, with WWDC.
Yeah, I mean, WWDC will be the first chance to see the new software.
Did you launch Chrome again?
No, I did nothing.
Wow.
But it only happened when you start talking. It wasn't like in the middle.
Yeah.
So maybe
Something.
It's like Renee usually has so much intelligent things to say. The best thing is for him to simply keep saying those intelligent things. It will enhance the show, and it will also keep the static off the channel.
Begin each statement with,
Is it really broken again?
No, it's fine.
That's fine.
It's something about like, this is my guess, and I'm not going to edit this out so everybody heard what happened. My theory is that if we don't talk to you and nothing happens with you, Skype does something. It like goes to sleep, and then it wakes up again.
Maddening.
And then in that wake up period, there's some junk. Anyway, why is it? Apple, it seemed to me that in years past, and this is our eighth year of doing this show, we've never had this period of just there's nothing really to talk about.
It's a combination of things. One is they've gone on these yearly cycles. So it takes a year roughly, sometimes a little bit quicker, sometimes a little bit longer, but roughly a year to get to a new version of OS X and iOS. And because they do that every June at WWDC, we have to wait again every June for another WWDC to see new software. And because they really are pushing hardware as fast as they can go, it takes them a while to get those devices to market. Like they were trying to get the iPads out on time. The iPad mini shipped, you know, at the last possible second it should have shipped to still be out. And they're just running out of time on making these products because a yearly cycle again. And I think we're going to keep seeing that. It's going to take them until they absolutely have to get the product out before we see it.
I'm still hoping that they'll do a Mac mini at some point soon. But that's not was that the kind of thing you'd announce at a WWDC?
Maybe. I mean, because it's for a lot of developers overdue. Use them. Yeah. Yeah, they just slot them into their existing development.
Wasn't that the pitch? That was the pitch on the Mac Mini. You're a PC. Remember that? You're a PC developer. You've already got everything you need. Just put a Mac Mini on top of your tower, switch the cables, and now you're good. I remember that.
And I know so many developers who've done just that. They were PC developers. Maybe they were Palm OS developers, and they just bought a Mac Mini, plugged it, bring your own keyboard, monitor, and mouse, and they're good to go.
Yeah. And every time I open the door to someone's network closet, almost any kind of office, I will see like these really expensive, really complicated like blade servers, like the size of phone booths. But somewhere there's always a Mac Mini that's in there somewhere, not necessarily running services, but running all the admin stuff. So that because none of these admins would like to administrate all this stuff with the tools that that a non-Mac will give them.
We have how many Mac Minis do we have in our exactly in our server closet downstairs? Tons of them. If you know, Chat-O-Matic, our chat room is running on a Mac Mini constantly. Our router is running on a Mac Mini constantly for the video switch, video hub. They're great little devices.
Minis are killer. I mean, I've been looking at NAS devices with an eye towards finding one that's easy enough to set up and use and administrate to actually recommend it to people. And I'm not quite at the point where I'm willing to say, okay, forget about it, just buy a Mac Mini. But man, when I compare the steps that I have to go through to keep a NAS running and also to make sure that I understand exactly everything that it's supposed to be doing on the network versus the same tools that are usually free on a Mac Mini, and the cost of a NAS versus a Mac Mini, I keep thinking, yikes, should this really just be talking about, I don't care if you're a Windows person, I don't care if you're a Mac person or any other operating system, this is some of the cheapest money you can buy in terms of having just one box on your network that never has a monitor connected to it, but can deliver so many services to all your devices.
And you don't need to run Apple's OS X server, although you can get it with server.
Right, but even if like for people who have just like an iPad mini, once you have like one device on the network that you can connect to and share screens with, suddenly you have an iPad that's Mac compatible that runs all your Mac software. Because now you have a Screens Connect or some other like really good screen sharing software for iOS, and now really who needs to get Office for iOS? Who needs to get Scrivener for iOS? Because you can run it very, very well from this thing. Might seem counterintuitive to buy a computer for the sole purpose of never actually sitting in front of it and doing anything with it. But once, I think after like 6, 7, or 8 months of incrementally keeping adding more services like a Plex server, more file servers and print servers and application servers, by the time you get this thing finished with these single click installations, wow, you've just so totally crushed everything that you'd like to do and made a really modern worldwide domination sort of global computing grid for yourself.
It's been a long time. I love Mac Rumors buying guide, because what they do is they keep track of not only rumors but how long since an update. 539 days since an update. That's almost 2 years. Although it is not, I note, the longest time since update. The March 2009 Mac Mini release ended at a 574-day drought. But it's coming close. The average is 381 days between releases. Rumors abound, but none of them have come true. One of them from January said end of February. Well, we're past that. It is certainly overdue, and Mac Rumors is saying don't buy, update soon. But when? But when?
Sometime.
Sometime. Yeah. The Haswell chips would make a lot of sense in a Mac Mini, not because of battery life, but just because of lower power, lower heat, and faster.
And not only the internals, but Apple is really becoming a much more design-focused company than it ever was. And for Apple, that's really saying something. They love to have products that just really look great. And I think that right now, the Mac Mini is the only really boring product that they have. Now that they've totally reinvented the Mac Pro, this is the only thing that's essentially a rounded rectangle, you know, QuickDraw 1.0 sort of CAD design tool. It has nothing really cool or interesting about it. It's just designed to be efficient and interesting. And so I really think that this design is just green and glowing as a target for Johnny Ive and his team to say, let's do something that is a radical redesign. Let's not even assume that people who buy this even want necessarily an internal mechanical hard drive. What if we were to make this as slim and compact as possible while still having as many ports as someone would want on a basic PC? I really think that that's going to be the highlight of whatever they come out with this year. And I do think that they're going to come out with something this year.
I look at what Amazon's done with the Fire TV, even though now these are ARM chips. But it really is an Apple TV-sized, full-blown computer, quad-core GPU. Yeah. No, very little storage. Have you heard anything, maybe, Renee, about the idea of a storage-less Mac Mini, one that you would just plug stuff into?
I have not. I was going to say, the one thing that's nice about Haswell also is the Iris graphics that come with it.
Yes,
because good, just like good the motherboard Retina MacBook graphics, Pro, yeah. Yeah, the Retina MacBook Pro was underpowered, the original one, and Haswell and Iris fixed all that. And the Mac Mini's graphics, you know, not the best thing in the world either, and Iris would really boost that. But the only thing I've heard is that a new Mac Mini is coming, and it's just, you know, it's currently missing in action. But I don't think they would do storageless or headless. That's the Apple TV's
right
wheelhouse.
It's a little Chrome-ish for a Mac.
Yes.
And yet, boy, that would be an interesting product.
Yeah.
I don't know. So according to Ryan Shrout at PC Perspective, host of This Week in Computer Hardware on this network, new Haswell processors are coming next month for desktop and mobile. 27 new desktop processors and 17 new mobile CPUs. They will replace the existing Haswell processors. I'm not sure what's new and different in them. The Haswell Refresh platform and its new motherboards and so forth. But the thing is, while I know Apple works ahead with Intel and Apple has very close relationships with Intel, would it, if they come out with these next month, would we see a Mac Mini next month? No. June would be good. That's WWDC time frame. Maybe.
Yeah, and they're a really patient company. They'll just wait until they have exactly the parts they want to upgrade. Yeah. It was the same thing with the Mac Pro. They just waited for Intel to ship new Nehalem processors and then whatever the, you know, the successor to that was. They wait until they have the components they need.
Apple really is kind of a Willy Wonka style company now, where they're so confident in what they're doing and they're so successful in all their product lines and they got so much money that they're sitting on that I can't imagine a single product track with the exception of the iPad Mini where they feel a lot of pressure from outside forces to make sure they keep rotating it and they keep refreshing it and keep improving things.
They don't really care, do they? They just...
Oh no, I wouldn't say they don't care. I think it's like a company like Samsung, all they got is the ability to produce interesting and new products on a regular schedule. Other companies, they are almost living hand to mouth as hardware manufacturers, and if their next notebook is not a hit, they got a big problem for the next 2 years. Apple has the ability to say that we like the Mac Mini, we think the Mac Mini is a great product, it's an important part of our lineup, we don't see a need to make people buy more of them in 2014. We are quite, you know, because they're going to be quite aware of what Intel's roadmap is, they're going to be quite aware of what their own internal roadmap is, and so if they feel as though they can let it kind of sit as it is for 2 years to make a really absolute killer update in 2016, there's no external force that's saying that no, you have to spike new sales of Mac Minis this year. So that's a enviable place for any tech company to be, to only be able to be free to make only the products they really, really want to make.
The next processor family will be the successor to Haswell will be Broadwell, and that has been delayed until the first quarter of next year. Do you tell me they're not waiting for Broadwell?
Not for the Mac Mini, no.
I mean,
Broadwell makes a lot of sense for the ultra-low-end laptop, not the ultra-low-power laptop market.
Right.
But I don't think the Mac Mini is constrained by that anymore.
You plug it in, so, you know, you don't need... Gosh, I just... So it sounds like maybe you think they're waiting, Andy, for Johnny Ive to come forward and say, here, I give you the best Mac Mini we've ever made.
I think that's a possibility, particularly even if you compare it to the other so-called boring computer that Apple makes, the iMac. They did something that was a little bit shocking design-wise for a desktop, a top-of-their-line desktop PC, which is to make this tiny, tiny razor-thin edge so that from certain angles it just looks like a pane of glass floating in the sky. And remember, before that, the iMac was very much like the Mac Mini. It was a rounded rectangle with a very nicely sculpted base to it, but a rounded rectangle. So it's possible that if there's one place to let imagination go free, right now that's the place to do it in the Mac line, or actually in the entire product line, to do it in the Mac Mini. They could do something that's so cool that just like I think a lot of people bought the Mac Pro partly because, oh, it's tubular, it's a black glossy tube, I must have it. I think that people who might have held on to their iMac for another couple of years or decided to keep their media server Mac Mini going for a while, if they came out with a circle with a ring of beautiful lights around it that communicates the intentions and the functions of this device in any given moment in a subtle way that's just really, really cool, and they enhanced it with a couple of interesting features, I think just the design of it would spike interest in the Mac Mini, at least get people to start remembering that this product exists.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems for the Mini, isn't it? It's just not something that leaps to mind. You think iMac, you think MacBook.
Maybe. It's a very... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Renee.
No, I was just going to say, like, to Andy's point, if they really are doing a redesign, Apple is not a highly parallel company when it comes to new designs. If they're working on a larger iPhone 6 that needs a new body, if they're working on an iWatch, a completely new, you know, product, they just finished doing the Mac Pro, they'll do that when they have time to do that. But there's just no way that design department scales to everything all the time.
Let's take a break. There is a big design shakeup at Apple in software. We'll talk about that. I'll give you an update on my Mac Pro. And we'll find some other things to talk about, including a rumor I don't credit, but everybody seems to be buying, that Amazon's going to have a phone later this year that'll feature 3D technology. Really? Really? Really?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Really?
Put your parallax on.
Can we start this week at Amazon?
Really? I just, every time I see this rumor, and it comes from, you know, Wall Street Journal and Boy Genius, I go, really?
I can't wait to use my Amazon phone to stream video directly to my Apple TV.
Oh, yeah, that'll happen.
I think that's going to be great.
Yeah, that'll happen. Our show today brought to you by Snack Time. Nature Box! Let me go get my new Nature Box. So Nature Box, we've talked about before. I love Nature Box. The idea is that having healthy snacks around, delicious, wonderful snacks that you want to eat that are free of all the junk that's in a lot of snack foods. It's just good for everybody. It's good for business. We have Nature Boxes all over the business. It's good for the home. Nature Box can be delivered to you monthly. You can get their variety of sizes with delicious treats. This is a brand new Nature Box. When you get your Nature Box, you can ask for an assortment. That's kind of what we do because there's a lot of different tastes here in the studio. But you can also say, if you know, I want savory or sweet or spicy only, or you can, if you have dietary needs, they have vegan, they have soy-free, gluten-conscious, lactose-free, nut-free, non-GMO. You get your choice. And that's kind of cool. Three different sizes. You get your 5, 10, or 20 snack bag box. Actually, we get several of them because we have a snack-happy crew here. What's nice is they work with Feeding America to provide food. 150,000 meals donated by Nature Box. And they're so delicious, which it really is the bottom line here. I could talk on and on about, you know, nutritionist approved, no trans fat, zero high fructose corn syrup, nothing artificial. I can go on and on about that, but then really it comes down to, are you going to want to eat it? How about these chili lime pistachios? We love these. The Fuji apples, the home style cheddar mix. Cheese. So this is, you know that other party mix. This is like you would make at home. I'm going to open this one up because I'm a fan. Wait a minute, though. Oh, gosh, now. Whole wheat raspberry figgy bars. That's Sarah Lane's favorite. She loves those. Italian bistro pretzels. You know, when Nature Boxes arrive here at the studio, they usually disappear within a day or two. You're going to love them, and that's why I want you to try it. And if you go to naturebox.com/twit, 50% off your first box. I have to do the Homestyle cheddar mix.
Let's do it, Leo.
Stay. You know what their slogan is? I love it. Stay full, stay strong. No more empty bellies here. Naturebox.com/twit. Oh, this looks so good. So much better. Cheese-flavored corn chips, corn nuts, and pretzels. Oh, man, that's not nice. I'm sure. I know. I'm sorry. Naturebox.com/twit. I love...
I hope we don't get like a major manufacturer of peanut butter as a sponsor because that could delay this show.
That could cost us. I just, it was always my dream to have food sponsors on this show.
And I got to tell you, thank you to you and Lisa, because there's nothing better than coming home from a trip and seeing a box and it's full of snacks.
Yeah, we sent you a box.
That's all you want. You just want to suddenly, without having to do anything, snacks appear and are ready to be eaten.
That's how it should be. That's how life should be. Did we send some to you, Renee?
Yes, they were absolutely fantastic. Oh, they lasted all of about a day and a half.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. They need bigger. We're going to need a bigger box. So Johnny Ive and Greg Christie apparently didn't quite see eye to eye. Christie is out. Ive, of course, still there. Christie joined Apple back in 1996. He's been there 18 years. He worked on the Newton. When Jobs came back, he cleared out a lot of people, but not Greg Christie. He is listed as the inventor on nearly 100 patents, has 31 pending patents right now. worked on software design, is widely credited as the co-inventor of Slide to Unlock. Sources at Apple say after 18 years at the company, Greg's decided to retire and cash in his shares, which is probably at this point worth quite a bit of money. Apple said Greg's been planning to retire later this year after nearly 20 years at Apple. It's not quite 20 years yet. It'd be 20 years in 2 years. He's made vital contributions to Apple products across the board and built a world-class human interface team, which has worked closely with Johnny for many years. He did testify in the Apple-Samsung trial last week in San Jose about Slide to Unlock, gave interviews about the process of designing the iPhone to the Wall Street Journal and NPR. So this, it's hard to say, you know, 9 to 5 Mac said it's following friction between top Apple human interface vice president Greg Christie and senior vice president Johnny Ive. Apple's hardware and software design is being dramatically shaken up. Ive, of course, has always been responsible for hardware design, but this is seen by some as a consolidation of his power in software as well.
Well, he already has the power in software. I don't think that this is as patent place-ish as people are making it out to be. Gruber used his sources to look into it, and he agrees this just seems to be, you know, a case of someone who's been at the same job for 20 years. And sometimes you wake up in the morning and realize that, wait a minute, how many tens of millions of dollars do I have? Why am I going to work in the morning? That sometimes you just, you're just ready to move on and do other things. That's what it looks like. I don't think any other company provokes so much speculation that anytime someone moves in or someone moves out, that's because there's a knife in someone else's back.
It's interesting, too, because I heard about this, I think, when I was out there for Macworld, and it announced it internally at Apple weeks prior to that. It was a well-known thing. It wasn't public, but it was a well-known thing. And like Henri Lamoureux, like Baz Olding, there's a bunch of people who've been at Apple for a really long time. And these are the people who basically, by force of will, got the iPhone to market. And they are tired, and they have to testify, and they have families who would dearly love to spend more time with their money. And it's just... there's so much incentive for them just to want to take a break. There might well have been friction. I mean, WWDC last year, he did the introduction for the interface talk, but he did not do the interface talk. And it's not the general style of design that he has historically done. So it might just be, you know, all things considered, this is his point. This is a very graceful point of exit for him.
Yeah.
I've heard that this is a common story from a lot of really big companies and really big creative companies where you'd wonder, gee, why would, if you got a job at, of really great creative responsibility at ILM or Disney or Pixar, why wouldn't you stay there for the rest of your career? And the thing is, a lot of these jobs attract the sort of people who get restless if they're faced with the same creative problems and the same challenges for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Because you have the sort of mind that you can, like Bill Atkinson, who spent years developing software, and now he wants to do photography because this is the lane that their brain is taking them down.
Yeah. But I mean, in that light, it makes a lot of sense. But it's also, you can see, I mean, both things might be true. You can Johnny Ive saying, hey, this is where we're going to go with software. Maybe it doesn't fit what Greg Christie felt. I mean, clearly, if he's been there 18 years, he has a lot to do with the original look of the iPhone, not the, you know, an iOS 7 may be a very big departure for him. So all in all, and he's got some money and he'd like to enjoy his family. And God knows, the iPhone's exhausting, right?
Organizationally, it makes a lot of sense too. Organizationally, it makes a lot of sense too, because previously, even though Johnny Ive was put in charge of all human interface, Greg Christie's department still reported to Craig Federighi, and Johnny would basically come and sit in on their meetings and give input. And it just wasn't the sort of pipeline. You wanted to have that track underneath Johnny Ive the same way you had industrial design under Johnny Ive. And now, at least organizationally, it makes a lot more sense as well.
Yeah.
It's an interesting. I don't think that this is a result of a fight that wound up one person winning, the other person going home. Nonetheless, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to the interfaces of everything that Apple makes over the past 2 or 3 years as Johnny Ive gets more and more control over more and more aspects of the things. Where there are few people to really talk to. Not that anything at Apple is ever one person deciding this is the way that we're doing things, but clearly, we're moving towards a place where I think that Apple's user interface design is going to be turning into more like the vision of a specific director so to speak, where it's not just lots of different products with lots of, with a common sort of design language, and it clearly came out of the same factory and the same foundries. Now we're talking about here is a small group of people who have a specific vision of what's best for humans and computers, and being able to consistently apply that one vision. So that's a great thing, because Apple has always been tops of the heap in terms of making things that work together very, very well, and making sure that if you buy a brand new product that you've never used before, the fact that it came out of that same foundry, that same shop, means that you're probably going to be 75% familiar with how to operate it. But as I was thinking about this the other day, that it's not what Apple's design direction. It isn't like, if you're going to compare it to directors, it's not like Scorsese or Spielberg, where there's a certain fingerprint on it, but it's kind of generic enough that it doesn't overwhelm how you come and approach the story and come and approach the product. I think that Apple's design has been getting a little bit more towards Wes Anderson or David Lynch, you know, where it's not as extreme as that, but it's definitely a point of view, and there's no way getting around that specific point of view. And so if you don't like that point of view of minimalist, take away as much detail as possible, make as quiet an experience as they can possibly put into pixel forms, if you don't agree with that, well, you're kind of stuck, because that really is the emphatic statement being made on every single device that they make. So I've never been so eager to see a new version of macOS as I am right now.
This one thing we know for sure is that, or maybe we don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but according to 9 to 5 Mac, that means all software designers, instead of working under Director of Engineering Craig Federighi, now work under Johnny Ive directly with his industrial design team.
That's my understanding as well.
So that's a significant change.
And if you think about, like, 5 years ago, Steve Jobs had a general idea of what he wanted, and the design team could make him 20 versions of a texture, and Scott Forrestal could say, these are the three that Steve will like, and then Steve will choose one of those. Right. And that entire process doesn't exist anymore. So Apple has to realign, whether Johnny Ive is the auteur now at Apple or not, that simple, you know, Steve Jobs, Scott Forrestal paradigm doesn't exist anymore. So other things have to change around.
I would guess Johnny's taking that role then, the Steve Jobs role. That is the one we're going to do, right? I mean, I don't think they're bringing it to Tim Cook and saying, Tim, what do you think?
I don't think the impression that I get, and again, my sources inside are not nearly as good as many other commenters, but the impression that I get is that there's nobody who has settled into the Steve Jobs role at Apple. That really this has been there's a group mind that's more powerful than any one single mind.
Yeah, it's my understanding as well.
You agree? Okay. I know nothing. You guys know more than I do, so.
Well, they have really talented people, and they tend to. If you look at Johnny Ives when he still does industrial design, they prototype everything. They sit down, they discuss it, they try to get to the essential nature of it. It's a very procedural thing, and I think the same will carry. My guess is that the same will carry over to human interface.
And the history of almost every significant Apple product, including the ones that were developed under Jobs, where lots and lots of people having lots and lots of discussions before it comes down to those three options that get presented to Steve. So it's not as though there's really, as much as I like to make a Wes Anderson comparison, because it means that seeing Grand Budapest Hotel is now tax deductible. If it's not that I've mentioned it on a podcast, it's always been a story of lots and lots of people who
you're
can
try to deduct your movie admission tickets.
I would not dare. I almost well God, played, I can't, Andy. I can't well even. Played. I don't want to talk about taxes, because this is as bad. This would be as bad as talking about Android on the Mac Break Show.
It is April 15th. Like, I just want to point that out.
There was so many years in my early career where I just short formed it, because I just don't even want to have to have it. Yeah. I don't want to have to figure out. Okay, yes, I did fly to Mac World Expo to write a bunch of columns, but while I was there, I did see some friends. So if they challenge this, I won't. Okay, let's just not.
They count on that, Andy. They count on that.
I don't let that talk.
And that's why Larry and Sergey pay so little tax, and you pay so much, relatively speaking.
Oh, because they make so much. They contribute so much more to the economy.
Perhaps, maybe not.
Andy.
I might have sold a few movie tickets today, but that's basically all I do for other industries.
Did you guys read Don Melton's long piece? It was originally in the Loop magazine, Jim Dalrymple's app. But Don Melton, the creator of Safari and a longtime Apple employee, going back to Next, I think, wrote a long article on his blog, Memories of Steve. Now, he wasn't exactly intimate of Steve's, But he has some, you know, it's an interesting story. He started the WebKit project at Apple. He says today he's a recovering programmer. it's fun to read these. He says he will not see the Steve Jobs movie. He did not read the Walter Isaacson bio because he has a few precious memories of working with Steve, and he doesn't want them colored by other people's impressions, which I kind of understand.
Yeah. There was a Sundance premiered in January, the biography of Roger Ebert. And because I contributed to the Kickstarter, so I was able to watch it streamed. And yeah, it's a very, very weird thing when someone that you knew very, very well is now the subject of a film or a documentary that's designed for people who never knew him. And so it's a weird experience. So I definitely understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm privileged to call Don a friend, and he's a remarkable guy. And he did Mozilla, and then he did Nautilus, and then he did WebKit and Safari. And he's also responsible for hiring a ton of people who now have very senior positions at Apple. And just his stories are fantastic. And those stories in particular there, I think, are just terrific. If you go through them, especially the one where he ends up sitting back down and saying, "I'm so fired." Just because they add sort of a lot of the flavor, and you remember that people who work at Apple, like every company, are human beings and not just drones out there to, you know, frustrate us and not give us what we want immediately when we want it.
Yeah, yeah. That's the story of sitting in the Apple cafeteria eating, and there's a few empty seats, and they noticed a familiar face looking for an open table, and it was a long time Macintosh designer, Bud Tribble, co-founder of Next, and they all knew Bud Tribble, so they say, "Hey, there's Bud over there. Did you guys see him? What's he doing here?" Ken and I hadn't seen Bud in months, not since Easel shut down, so we were all making guesses about the reason for his visit. Tired of the conjecture, I finally just stood up, cupped my hands, and called out to him, "Hey, Bud, come over here and see your old pals when you're done talking to that guy." Bud looked up, slight pause, and that guy turned around to stare at me. It was Steve Jobs. I will forever remember his look, a slightly lopsided, tight-lipped, half-smile, eyes narrowed. I've seen that look, actually. As if to say, "I don't know who you are, but I won't forget that." When I sat back down, at least I didn't say something smart-ass like, "I am so fired," in front of my two engineers, although that's what I thought at the time. Ken and Richard thought it was pretty funny when Steve turned back around. Until he did, I think they were holding their breath, too. Spoiler alert, I did not get fired. Hey, Bud! Yeah, it's fun. Did you know Don before he went to Apple, or?
No, I knew him afterwards. Yeah. He came on one of the podcasts, and we had a good conversation. Neat. And now, once a month, I get together with Don and Matt Drance and Guy English, and we talk about 80s movies, which is the funnest thing in the world.
I love it. Well, it's nice. It's a very long blog post. It's definitely one for Pocket or, read it later. But
this is something I keep coming back to. It must be really, really hard to be at a senior level at Apple, knowing that so many people outside of Apple are going to imagine a reality series and try to cast you in whatever role they need you to fill in that reality series, as the person who just does part of the old guard who's going to be swept aside by the new designers, as the person who has a new vision for Apple and is trying to be combative and argumentative, as the person who's carrying the spirit of Apple with them and are defending it against the incoming ogres and barbarians. It must be. It's something that you really don't get at Samsung or Google or really any other company, where you just are allowed to do your job and do your projects as best you can without other people imagining that they know what your point of view is and what your goals are at the company.
He talks about the rehearsing for the Safari announcement. Jobs wanted to prank Phil Schiller. So yes. He has a slide deck going along. And in the last slide, I guess he's talking about, let me see. I should get 1.4 million visitors in the month of December alone to this story. He said, "So to all of you in the press who doubted us," and then he throws up the slide, which has a 1940s style rendering of a grinning man holding a big mug of coffee next to his face. "How about a nice cup of STFU?" Although he spelled out the STFU, and then he looks at Phil and he says, "What do you think, Phil? Too much?" of course, it was a joke, and it didn't make it to the deck. But it's actually good to hear stories of a Steve Jobs being lighthearted and fun, because all we're hearing these days is of, you know, Steve the Tyrant. So it's nice to hear those others, the other side as well.
Well, even the parts about the code review in there, when he and Steve would turn to each other and decide on a, like how a feature should work in the program.
Yeah.
It's just nice to know that, you know, Steve Jobs was looking at how that bar filled itself with
right,
color.
Right. Yeah. Talking about Safari for Windows, and so forth. And, by the way, good, kind things to say about Scott Forstall as well. Scott made a great boss. He backed me up. So
he did
this
some
is,
amazing things.
Yeah.
He championed Carbon. He championed the App Store.
Yeah. Yeah. Worth reading if you want to add to your stock of stories about Apple and understanding, I think, of Apple under Steve Jobs. Let's see. Apple is testing Maps notifications to inform users of problems that have been fixed. That'll never make it into a product.
people are occasionally getting them.
Mac Rumors says some of their readers have reported with screenshots that they received push notifications. So if you report a problem, like there, you know, that bridge is out. Later, when Apple fixes the map, you can expect a little notification saying that problem has been fixed.
Yeah.
Unclear whether that'll be in the.
That's such a smart idea because we're all used to the idea of when you click on that button and say yes, please report this crash. You imagine that this goes into this big hopper where it's mixed up with all kinds of extra electrons, and God knows if that has any positive effect whatsoever. As soon as you get some sort of a feedback that yes, someone did look at this and this actually enhanced the experience, that's going to encourage you to go throughout your own local neighborhood and try to fix as much of the map as you possibly can. And that's the strength of any map service. It's not how to get from Boston to Newark by the highway system. It's about how to get from the post office in Dedham, Massachusetts to the Chipotle on Route 1 in Norwood. As these little street things that that tell you that no, you don't want to take Route 1. You want to, there's actually a 1A next to it that has absolutely no red lights and will get you there faster. If you can sort of trick people into thinking that their help actually has an effect, you can actually get the greatest ground crew possible and create a really kick butt mapping service.
Here's the shot from MacRumors.com. Sent in by one of its readers who had reported a problem, and then they get a little notification that says the problem you reported on April 6th has now been addressed. Thank you for reporting this problem. They should do that. That's a great idea. That encourages people to do it. So you're being heard. I like that idea.
Yeah.
Makes you feel good about the product.
And it isn't in any way, it's not an admission of failure. It shouldn't be seen that way. All maps have to be updated all the time.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing.
Now, do they still call the public garden the public gardens in Boston?
Oh, now you ought to fix that, and you'd get that nice thank you.
I got to check that again.
Yeah.
I know this is like if a movie gets filmed at your former high school and they show a chase going from the cafeteria through the English department, you say the cafeteria is near the science wing, not the English. I know this is a pathetic thing to complain about, but it's something I keep noticing every time and it bothers me.
Well, maybe you'll be glad to know that Apple, according to Apple Insider, is using Wi-Fi access points for indoor navigation. They'll fix that. And 3D positioning. It's a patent, though, so it doesn't mean that they've implemented it yet. But a patent that was granted to Apple on Tuesday describes a robust system that combines GPS, Wi-Fi access points, and onboard location databases to provide mobile devices accurate positioning even when you are inside. So you'll know where that cafeteria is. It's about time. Are we going to see a big new version of Maps before iOS 8, you think, Renee? Or is all of this because they've acquired Hopstop, Locationary, Broadmap, Embark? They're really beefing up their data. They could do it sooner, I suppose, than iOS 8. Will they wait to iOS 8?
Well, I think the answer to that is an appalling yes and no. And the thing is that adding in features like transit is going to require new buttons in the interface and a new way of presenting data. So that will be iOS 8 specific. Things like improving the back end, like apparently they're going to be doing a lot of data sanitizing and data cleansing, right, and just making the stuff that they've already got, because they have great TomTom data, they have great data from several providers, but just making it more uniform and more accurate. And that will just depend on how they stage the rollout. That's all server-side stuff. So it'll be a combination of both of those things, whether they beta test the server-side stuff during the iOS 8 beta just because it's convenient and makes a lot of sense to them, I don't know, but that's certainly a possibility.
Be nice. You know, I mean, Google updates maps every 5 minutes. I don't, you know, why not?
You're standing there and they're updated.
Yeah. And by the way, a new interface, new buttons, no problem. Facebook does that.
But that also points out that you have to be really conservative and really protect the integrity of your map datums. It's well known that a lot of businesses are gaming Google Maps by if you call for I need a locksmith, I need a snowplow service, I need whatever. They basically because they can add stuff to the map themselves, or at least encourage. There's a system for enhancing maps that they basically flood a certain area with like hundreds and hundreds of quote local unquote snowplow, locksmith, or whatever services, so that instead of calling what you think is going to be a shop that's located 1.2 miles away, you're actually calling a call center that will then dispatch someone that has subscribed to a service that they run. And so there's nothing that can't be ruined by commerce by adding a little bit too much freedom to the mix.
Scooter X in our chat room says, Apple still reports a Caro's restaurant in the middle of a nearby park. I've reported it many times. It's still there.
You should open one there. Think of the business you'd get.
I think a chicken fried steak in the middle of a park, that sounds like a good meal to me.
Who are you to turn down free location advice from people who run the Apple stores?
I actually used to go into the local Caro's just to get chicken fried steak. And that, my friends, is why I will be dead in the next 5 years. Our show today brought to you by Gazelle. Ladies and gentlemen, I know you have a hankering. You wouldn't be listening to the show if you didn't have a hankering for the latest, greatest shiny toy or gadget. But how do you pay for that? Do you sell your old gadget? Sometimes people do. I know our chat mod, Dan, is famous for having all the latest, greatest stuff. I said, Dan, given what we pay you, which is nothing, I don't know how you do that. And he says, well, I sell them. I sell the old ones. Here's the easiest way to get cash, even for a broken iPhone or a broken iPad. Cash for your Samsung device. Time to get out of that. You thought it was a good idea at the time, but now you're realizing you miss your iPhone. Sell your old stuff at Gazelle. Got an old iPhone 5? Want to get some cash so you can get the new one? No cracks, no problem. Look at that price. Look at that price. You can unlock it, by the way, and get $40 more, $230 for an iPhone 5 from AT&T. But they do buy cell phones from BlackBerry, you don't get as much, HTC, Samsung, Nokia. Yes, they will buy your Surface tablet. They will buy your Google Nexus tablet, your Samsung or Asus tablet, even a Kindle Fire. And the nice thing about this is this quote that you're going to get is guaranteed for 30 days. So when you see that quote, boy, a Kindle Fire is not worth much. The resale value, not great on the Kindle Fire. The Apple stuff, really, the resale value holds wonderfully. When you see that quote, you have time now. You could say, you know, I think I'm going to wait and see what they come up with next. I'm going to transfer my data over. And then within 30 days, you can pull the trigger. They'll send you a box with a prepaid mailing label on it and everything. You pile all the stuff you've gathered. In fact, go through all those drawers and closets and, you know, sell all the stuff that's just sitting around gathering dust. Yeah, your old Apple TV is worth some. Gazelle.com, they pay the postage. They turn it around fast. If you forget to wipe the data, or as in the case of an Apple TV, you can't figure out how to wipe the data, don't worry, their experts will do it for you. And then they'll send you a check, but if you're in a hurry, you can get a PayPal credit. Or if you use a lot of Amazon, which I do, then do get the Amazon gift card because that's an additional 5%. They bump you up on that. Gazelle's paid out more than $100 million now to over 700,000 customers. They are the guys, the gals, the people to bring your stuff to. Gazelle.com. Do it today. And I thank you for it. So I am not going to Gazelle my Mac Pro. Good news.
Good.
But you know, it's interesting. Apparently there's a problem with some Mac Pros. I mentioned last week that they were doing a capture. Mine is not in that range of serial numbers, but after I sent them the log that showed them repeated crashes and kernel panics and reboots, they said, well, we better send you a new one. So we're going to do a swap, which I'm happy about. stock is still very limited on these Mac Pros. And I do you so by the way, I think I got a bad one, but I think that most people are happy with them. I don't hear widespread problem reports. Do you think that the stock is so limited because they can't make them fast enough, they can't get the parts, or the demand is so high? Are there rumors, Renee? Anything you're hearing? You've got your ear to the ground.
Well, the components, I believe, I'm not sure right now, but as of a month ago, I think all those base components, especially the graphics cards and the chips, were still in slow supply. It's a new manufacturing process, which always takes time to ramp up. And because people have been waiting so long, there probably were more orders than there will be over the normal course of a couple of years.
Yeah,
so
there was a pent-up demand.
Yes. Yeah. So it's probably a pent-up demand along with a slow ability to supply that demand.
My advice, and I think this holds true. I know Alex Lindsay always said this. He just doesn't want to buy the first one off the line, except we always do because we want to be the first in our...
Don't buy Rev-A boards, but we want Rev-A boards.
Yeah, don't buy Rev-A boards. But is it even more the case when it's not only a Rev-A board, but a brand new plant, brand new manufacturing process, brand new everything? That seems to me much more likely there'll be some kinks initially.
Yeah, that's my constant advice to everybody. Whenever I don't have many problems when Apple just uses the same body design and simply upgrades the CPU and the internals. When they go to a brand new body design, though, they haven't really figured out how to make this in quantity until they've made them in quantity. Yeah. That's the only time when they figure out that, okay, we need to put less adhesive on this spot because it's causing a heat buildup.
Right.
So that's why I tend to wait for revision B of anything.
It's true for cars. You don't want to buy the first car in a brand new product line.
My favorite cars are fleet style vehicles because
they made by the time
they've been making that Toyota for 8 years, they've cranked out so many copies that every single defect has been dealt with. And if it's designed to be run by cops and taxi drivers, that big block engine is just not going to screw up. I have an old car. It's got high mileage and the engine is like, you cannot destroy this. I blew a coolant hose on my drive back from the airport. And I thought, well, maybe this is it. But no, driving it hot for 5 miles did nothing to the engine, just new hose and had an oil change while it was there, and it's good. I think the same principle really affects technology too. You should be a little bit, not skeptical, but a little bit cautious about getting the first version of a brand new design because they do all the diligence they have to do, and it's the best they can make at that point. But you never know what the weaknesses in the manufacturing process are until you've punched out millions of these.
And that is why Andy drives a Crown Victoria.
So it's like you have computer nerds.
Police Interceptor
you're joking,
model.
You're joking. I my next car, I really want to buy a Crown Vic. I'm telling you, if any product, whether it is a car, a computer, or a pizza, if they ask you, would you like the police pursuit package with
yes.
that? Yes, of
yes,
course.
I
why would.
Would
I not want something called the police pursuit package?
I did not buy the police pursuit package on my Mac Pro, however.
Okay.
Leah, you have these competing nerds. You have like the one nerd on your shoulder going, "Don't buy the Rev-A board." You're going, "You'll be the first one in Petaluma with a Mac Pro."
Well, and I did, but I have an excuse, which is that so I can review it. I wanted to get it as fast as possible. And thanks again to Ed Ingber, who is one of our listeners, who did buy it I didn't buy it the first day, and then I found out I won't get it for a month and a half or whatever. Fortunately, he did, but had second thoughts, got an iMac instead. Probably a wise decision. And I bought it from him, transferred it over to me, so it's under warranty and all of that stuff. Because he never even got the box. I think it just came straight to me. I have to say, one thing about the Mac Pro, we mocked a little bit the design and thought, well, it's going to be under the table. Nobody's ever going to see it. It isn't. It's so small that you really do keep it on your desk. And it's pretty there. And it's also convenient because you can plug stuff in and out. And it really looks good on the desktop. So I think that that's going to be a great model as soon as they work out the kinks.
Is it staying clean? Is it getting dusty?
It is not getting dusty. Although, okay. From now on, I wish, and Apple, just a little tip, ship it with white gloves. I've literally received speakers, I think, I can't remember, was it Aperion? One of the speaker companies, either Emotiva or Aperion, ships white gloves with their speakers. And if Apple would only do that, then I wouldn't have the – because it is when you take it out, you hold it, and then I have got fingerprints on the side of it.
Yeah.
So it should be white-gloved, my suggestion.
If for nothing else, that a pair of white gloves, cotton gloves, has got to cost like something like
nothing.
20 cents.
Yeah.
But the impact that you make
exactly.
– I never know – sometimes like I'm shown stuff like 6 to 8 months before it's – being like announced or shipped. And I know it's a big deal if it's in a custom Anvil case. I know it's a really big deal if the first thing that they see after they take off that little egg crate, you know, like foam, is that there are two sets of gloves so that whoever picks this up does not put any skin oil on it or anything like that. I don't know if that's just a little bit of theatrics, but again, I think that if you've paid $3,000 for a desktop computer, give me theatrics. Give me the full experience.
Yeah. So yes,
give me cotton gloves.
Yeah. What else was I going to say about it? Oh, Silent? Yes. Mm-hmm. I've been running, you know, BioShock Infinite. I've tried to tax the dang thing, and I can't. I'm not editing 4K video. But no matter what I do, I don't hear a thing. In fact, I told you the other day that the loudest thing is that old FireWire drive that I have on the desk as a backup drive. I turn it off because I don't want to hear. Everything is dead silent. It's so nice. So nice. And as far as I can tell, and I'll put my hand right over that fan, and it's a little warm sometimes. I don't ever feel heat. It really is a nice, nice piece of hardware. So I don't want to scare anybody off because of my issues. I think that I suspect they fixed them by now. I watch forecast from a company called KGI and our favorite Ming Chi Kuo. And Ming's pretty good, right? Am I right? He's pretty good.
I mean, it depends on if you're grading on a curve. And I get in an argument about this because people say he's really reliable. But when you look at like this is his 2014 roadmap, which is usually one of the least reliable things because it's only April and he's predicting stuff up until the end of October. And that's really, really hard to do, especially with supply chain sources. But if you look at the 2013 version of this, maybe 40%, 50%. And a lot of that was, you know, Apple's going to make new iPads. Apple's going to make new iPhones. So, I mean, it's worth looking at. It's worth discussing, but I wouldn't be placing large wagers on them.
I'm going to look up his 2013 roadmap real quickly just to see. This is the nice thing about the internet.
He had a new Apple TV. He had a new Mac Mini. He had a redesigned MacBook Pro, which you could argue maybe the 13 was. Mm-hmm. There was no new Mac Pro on his roadmap.
Here's his 2013. Apple TV refresh. Did that happen?
No.
No. iPhone 5S, third quarter, yes. New design, yes. iPhone 5, yes, that was the C, right? Mm-hmm. iPad 5, the Air, yes. iPad Mini 2, yes. He was right on the MacBook Air coming out in Q2 towards the end. That was, of course, WWDC. Mm-hmm. In fact, the new design Retina came out then too, right? So he was a little off in the timing on that. He did say there'll be a new iMac and Mac Mini in the fourth quarter of last year. No. Modified iPod Touch 5, no.
No.
iPod Nano refresh, no.
And the stuff he did get right were things that Apple has done previous years in those time slots.
So that was more like induction than deduction.
Well, there's going to be an iPad 5 and a new iPad Mini this year because there wasn't last year.
Right.
Again, he might have sources saying that, but it's still, those aren't.
Well, here's the thing some of those are just, of course they're going to do that. But here's the interesting thing. He says towards the end of the third quarter, a all-new 12-inch ultra-slim MacBook and MacBook Pro Retina upgrade. We've talked about that before. He says around the same time, an Apple TV upgrade. I don't know if anybody's waiting with bated breath for an Apple TV upgrade. Are they?
Apple's feeling a lot of... I really think that Apple's going to be feeling a lot of pressure to do something really big with the Apple TV. You compare it with what Amazon just did with the Fire TV, and I'm switching AB between these two, and the Apple TV feels slow. The interface seems confusing. The software just feels like it's right from 2004, 2005, 2006. An AB test. It's just no comparison.
If Apple's not good at multitasking, it seems that the Apple TV is not a high priority development. And that what you just described is a major redesign, not just a refresh.
Well, I mean, a new CPU to make it more fluid, a new user interface that make it more iOS-like. These are and believe it or not, although I think everybody's pretty much half and half on what they like and don't like about iOS 7, it's a revamp that would look really, really great on a TV screen if they were to make it darker as opposed to lighter. So, yeah, they wouldn't have to throw everything away and start all over again so much as just simply tweak the interface so that it doesn't look quite so primed for 480 pixel standard definition TV.
So are you voting for it or are you saying it's likely?
I hesitate to say anything is likely unless it's Apple has been on a regular schedule of releasing something on a certain date. I think that this is not only is it primed for an update, it's different from the Mac Mini in which this is a very important market for them because
it's not a hobby anymore.
It's not just a $99 box. It's the gateway to selling all kinds of content off the iTunes store. Right. And also, Apple's language on the Apple TV has changed so much in the past 8 months where not only did Tim Cook say, it's hard for us to call this a hobby anymore, but now they're willing to talk about how much money they're making off of this thing. Right. So yeah, I'm sure that this is as big a problem of lawyer stuff and legal deals as it is of engineering. But this is something where Apple, I think they're gonna have it would be like a full event almost about how much new stuff they bring to the Apple TV at this point. At least I hope so because again, it's become such an interesting segment of the market right now. Where I got on my own TV, I've got the Roku 3, I've got the Amazon Fire box, and I've got the Apple TV, and I can have a nice debate about the differences between the Roku 3 and the Amazon. About well, this one does this better, this one does the other thing better. But I mean, this Apple TV is like the number three superpower at this point. It's number one and number two, and then there's a hell of a drop off before number three at this point.
You agree, Renee?
It's old. Yeah, no, I mean, that's 2012, spring 2012 hardware. It was announced alongside the iPad 3. Right. And look how far we've come with the iPad.
We should at least put an A7 in that sucker.
Yeah, it's a single core A5. It's 8 gigabytes of NAND memory. It's not equipped to do the kind of stuff that Fire TV is doing. Even if they just modernize it, if there was an A7 in there, if it was given more storage, if it was given more RAM, I think it's 512 now, if it went up to a gig or two of RAM.
Right.
If Apple finally put the SDK in the field, and even if it's not an app SDK, if it's a game SDK, iOS is one of the best gaming. Maybe the best is the wrong word, but one of the premier gaming platforms right now, and there's just so many people and so many games that could do that could add so much value to the ecosystem. I mean, throw Spotlight Universal Search on there, refresh the interface to iOS 7. We do know that Apple's got some incredibly talented people working on Apple TV software right now. Mark Gurman has heard about a new box. Jim Dalrymple has said it's not coming anytime soon. I don't know how big or small those timelines are, but I think we hopefully will see one this year, and I think that would be a much more competitive version.
Amazon's Fire TV does pose a threat to the ecosystem, doesn't it? I mean, it's
in the U.S.
In the U.S., not in your neck of the woods, but because it is a credible gaming device. It's basically an Android device with quad core, 2 gigs of RAM, a dedicated GPU, a controller for an additional $40. So you really and Amazon's really. In fact, they've got a gaming studio. They're really pushing the notion that it is a gaming.
Yeah. It gives them an ecosystem play to put against Apple.
And they have an ecosystem play. You know, it's the Apple. It's the App Store is Amazon's. The content is Amazon's. The games are Amazon's.
The phone might be Amazon's.
Yeah, maybe a phone. We'll talk about that in a little.
And it is a full Android box, so it's not limited to. At least their ambitions for this aren't limited to just let's just have a host device to run a Netflix app and a Hulu app. This can really do absolutely anything that Amazon decides that it wants to do. And the other advantage is that you can't ignore that. The Apple TV is a fantastic gaming device so long as you have a $400 iPad to play it with, so long as you have a $200 iPhone to play it with. With the Fire TV, $99 plus, let's say, $40 for that really good controller, and you have a $140 game console. That's going to be really, really attractive to people like me who I have an interest in gaming, but I'm no way in hell I'm going to be spending $500 for a next-generation console. I just want something so I could play my little racing game and play Cannonball Cannonball and other games like that on a big TV from the comfort of a sofa with a really good controller in my hands.
All right. Okay. So other things Ming-Chi, and I do think the 12-inch is fairly credible. Other things Ming-Chi Kuo says will happen. He says the watch, the iWatch, come out mid-third quarter in two sizes. What's that based on, Renee? You have any idea?
Well, I mean, that's the theory that you would need, because there's different size people. There's men, women, young, old. That you'd need at least two sizes.
That's that kind of size. Not
Yeah,
not like the not like the Samsung Gear right. where it's got a band one and a square one, but
no,
not so different.
Screen
okay.
size.
Okay. All new, and this is the other one that we're hearing a lot of rumors about. All new iPhone designs, two of them, a 4.7-inch iPhone.
Oh, Leo, before you go on, you skipped the part where he thinks that there might be an iWatch is up to $1,000, $2,000, or $3,000.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The most expensive version costing upwards of $1,000. He says it will come in a 1.3-inch and 1.5-inch flexible AMOLED display, sapphire cover lens. I think that's reasonable. Biometric recognition. Can you put a fingerprint reader in that? I don't know.
I think that's ridiculous. That takes up a lot of space.
When
people are speculating about things, they might have sources they can't reveal, and they might have an insight that they can't really share. And I'm willing to say that who knows? You know, many things are possible. But as soon as you start talking about a $1,000 watch, that's ridiculous. At the moment that Apple, and I expect this to come back to haunt me, but I will phrase this the way that I want to phrase it. The moment Apple comes out with a $1,000 wristwatch is the moment that I think that we can be a little bit concerned about their grip on reality, because that's a fine price for Google to put onto a device that they don't know if they're going to market or not. So they can say that, look, we're only making about 5,000 to 8,000 of these. So we have to make sure that we can manufacture these and not lose our shirts in the process. Okay, that's fine. So now you're a special person with one of only 5,000 Joni Ive designed wristwatches. But if they're expecting anybody to do that, this is not the company that I know. So this is the reason why I'm willing to simply completely dismiss that as it's just not reality.
Jason Snell's tweeted, according to Scooter X, he believes it will use the iPod name. Hooper said that recently, too.
I think the iWatch would be interesting. The way Apple replaced the iPod originally with the iPhone, and they used the iPad to hedge against lower Mac sales. I think that the iPod continues to go. It plummets in terms of how much money it's making for Apple. That a wearable could be something that replaces that revenue. And they've had wearable iPods in the past. The iPod Shuffle clipped onto your tie. They've had iPod Nanos that clip on. Those were wearable devices. And these could be wearable devices that run iOS. But I mean, it could go either way. I agree with Andy that the really expensive one makes very little sense to me. I could see a range of products eventually, from a very, very cheap shuffle like exercise band to a nano to maybe a $400 like premium version that does magical things. If you start making a gold and diamond encrusted one, fashionistas you hire, that does not seem like a traditional Apple
product. I don't think that's the case. I do think it's possible that Apple will say, look, if we are willing to charge $1,000, we can put really interesting new technology in this thing that we couldn't put in a $300 or $500 one. Why don't we do a reference design? We don't expect a lot of people to buy it, but we just want to say, and it's not going to be diamond and gold. I mean, that's not the point of it. Yes, I'm sure all of them will be good looking because of the hires. But what if they say there's technologies we could put in here. I don't know what they are. Holographic 3D projection.
The Mac Pro of watches.
Yeah. They did it with the Mac Pro, didn't they?
No, but that's still a credible product.
Yeah, because there's a market.
And also, let's not forget the people who are buying a Mac Pro expect to make money with use of this Mac Pro. Apple, as much as we joke about, we might joke about how there's an Apple tax that you have to spend an extra $300 or $400 for a laptop because of the Apple logo and the Apple design. And as much as we might joke about how infatuated Apple can be about design sometimes, to the extent of making a pro level MacBook that doesn't have a networking port on it, they are still a consumer-focused, consumer-driven company. And I think they appreciate that once they put a $1,000 price tag on a watch, the expectations of what this is supposed to do and the amount of pleasure it's supposed to give the user will be so high out of proportion with what they can deliver that they would just throw that right off the drawing board. I even think that $500 would be a stretch, although I think that would be, in my own mind, that's sort of the high mark for what Apple might charge for such a thing. But again, this would still be a premier item with styling that has absolutely no compromises and even a display technology that we haven't really seen in a mass market device before. You've got great devices that are going for $130 right now, and a lot of different makers that seem to be aiming for $250 as a price point. And I think that when you're trying to get people to buy something that they've never really heard of before, let alone owned before, wow, every $50 takes the 10% of their interest away.
There is a group of people who pay more than $1,000 for a watch. I mean,
but these are people who are real fans of watches. I've got a couple of friends who are watch collectors who will show me this $1,200 watch they bought, and they will talk really passionately about how it was manufactured and how the movement works and the design and the simplicity about how it was completely manufactured by hand. They are not the people. And when I show
them, we're not talking Swatch Fires either. I mean, there's got to be some middle ground.
Yeah, but I'm saying that you're not going to get people who simply love watches spending $1,000 on this watch, unless it's like a Johnny Ive Red model, which is we were only making 50 of these. It cost $10,000, and most of that goes to some sort of a charity.
Quo also says that an NFC chip. I don't buy that. Apple's done nothing with NFC.
They couldn't care less about NFC.
Why would they put an NFC? Bluetooth wireless charging? Yes, that would be that's important. I don't know if you can.
Yeah,
because you just can't. If it's a real pain in the butt to charge a Pebble, right, Chad?
It also means you got to put a port into
it's not a big pain in the butt. It's a big pain in the butt.
It lasts 4 days.
Well, that's the difference.
What Apple will care about is the fact that if they're going to do that kind of a charger, they're going to have they're going to have to mars the side of it with two like little copper contacts for the magnetic thing.
That's ugly. I want to take off my watch at night and put it on a pad. Then it can charge every night.
I don't even want that. I want them to make a Velcro strap that you wrist over
Please, there's not going to be any Velcro in an Apple watch.
Okay, a magnetic strap.
What are you, an astronaut?
Sorry.
What do you want, Velcro? So go ahead, Renee. We cut you off.
No, I was just laughing at the Velcro thing. But I think that, you know, both the iPhone and the iPad entered mature gadget markets. Like, they weren't widely adopted, but
this is a new market.
Thing for a long time.
Not mature, anyway.
BlackBerry had been a thing. This is brand new. This is more like the iPod, where Apple put out a device that was expensive for what it did at the time. The original iPod was really expensive, held very few songs, but it was something that over time began to appeal to a wider audience, and Apple slowly diversified the product family. And the iWatch could be similar, where the first ones, because of all the technology they're going to put in, are going to be towards that $500 mark that Andy mentioned. But in a couple of years, 2, 3, 4 years, we could have a wide array from $50 up to $500 again. Apple likes those $100 or $50 increments, and they like spreading themselves out across.
I have to say, one of the things that comes out of this discussion is that it's obvious that there's a wide range of people with a wide range of ideas of what a watch is. I mean, Chad wants a Velcro strap.
Okay, magnetic.
Don't change your mind, because that's the point. Wristwatches are super personal. I'm willing to spend. I'm a watch buff. I'm willing to spend a lot of money on a watch and have. Andy perhaps is more utilitarian. I mean, I think that this is a very odd market for Apple.
But it's also so many little complicated things. I mean, I have been hauling out, like last week you saw me, I was wearing my Microsoft Spot watch that's from 10 years ago. So I've been hauling out anything that's a wearable technology to sort of remind myself of the past. And here is, you know, I've shown this before, the on-hand like wrist PC. And I can't wear it because, look, this crappy little jelly strap.
Got to get rid of that.
After using it. So that's going to be as important to the user as what this little screen actually does.
And may I point out that people, I don't know in what numbers, but a fairly large number of people are paying $1,500 for Google Glass.
But again, it's totally different.
It's not much utility.
No,
they're not buying it for a useful piece of technology. They're buying it because here is something brand new that they can sort of start investigating that might even fit in perfectly with how they happen to use a computer. I think this is the perfect way to introduce a product like that, where you can charge $1,500 because you are finding people who are journalists accepted. They're buying this because they are pre-selected to be interested in this sort of technology. They're not going to, if it were $100, they'd wear it for about 2 days, record some stupid stuff, write about what a piece of crap this is with absolutely no purpose. When you get people who are that interested as the first adopters, though, they're the people who can appreciate that. Look, when I go on my 5-mile walk every day, this lets me really stay tuned in with my environment. And now I can record things that experiences that would have passed me by and blah, 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 blah. So there's still a lot of steps to make it into a practical consumer product. But the whole purpose of this experiment has always been, let's make this and see what people use with it. If Apple's making a real watch, and I'm not even 100% convinced that they're making a watch as opposed to something simply like a sports band, they're going to have to absolutely come off that block, those starting blocks at full speed. It's going to have to be an iPhone launch. It's going to have to be an iPad launch. It can't be like Apple TV, where they say, hey, here's something we're playing with, and it's a hobby for us. See if you like it. We'll keep it on the SKU.
I love what you, Renee, and Jason Snell concluded that Apple's not here to entertain us, and that was a good article. However, damn, this is entertaining.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, we actually had that conversation right after being on MacBreak together. We went next door, got some food, and had that conversation. And that strikes two things for me. One is that if Apple makes a watch, it discludes a large amount of the market. People who want fashionable high-end, you know, Panerais or Rolexes, or people who have watches for diving, because no one's going to wear two watches at the same time, or very few people. But if it's a band, you can wear it with a watch. You can wear it without a watch. You can wear it on the opposite arm from a watch. You can even wear multiple bands if you want and look like you're, you know, have an arm from the 80s. And that sort of feels more like an Apple market. But even taken as a band, and Ben Beharin is very good at putting these numbers up, there you would have to sell so many bands at such a high price to come anywhere near iPad or iPhone money that it's hard to think of an iWatch as anything but an Apple TV style ecosystem booster product for Apple and not the next big thing.
This is why I think that Android has the leg up on this, is because if you use Glass for a little while, I realized immediately that this was just a boon until they get it off your face and onto your watch. Because every swipe, every gesture is perfect for fitting onto a watch where you have lots of screen real estate.
By the way, that voice is Chad Johnson, our producer.
Video guy.
And aware of a pebble. Yeah. And I should point out, that was what I've been thinking about Glass, which is it is a laboratory for Google. It may not even be a product ever for Google. They want to understand wearables. And I'm sure Apple's watching with great interest. How many of the Apple design team do you think are wearing Glass?
And
The A-bomb for Google is Google Now and their notifications. The more I see that as this system matures and I see what they're able to do in this little square that's 2 inches by 2 inches, the amount of utility that they can deliver and the amount of information, context-perfect information they can deliver, I think about how well this works in a Google Glass environment. I think about how well it works on a watch screen. I think about if Google is actually going to come out with their own Roku style box. The idea of you're watching Netflix, you're watching Hulu, and this ability for this tiny little notification to ease in to tell you about something that, oh, by the way, you know, you have this appointment at 4 o'clock. Traffic is such that you should really leave right about now. Here is a map. If you want to action your way into that map, here's something you can do. It is a secret sauce that adds so much zest and so much utility to a wide range of products. So I don't think Apple has demonstrated this the same sort of thing with Siri, and it's because that they have sort of cut Siri off from that sort of visual communication.
And just like Renee and Leo were saying, there's no way that you're going to be able to make a watch for every person.
Right.
But that's not what Google.
Diverse market.
That's not what Google is promising. That's why you have LG and Motorola.
Like Google's smart. Make an API
and
make
let
an SDK,
everyone yeah.
and then let as many people. But Apple can't do that. Apple's a hardware manufacturer, and they don't have Google Now kinds of information because they've decided up front that they don't want to impinge on people's privacy. And that's one of the value propositions of Apple's phones.
They both deliberately made card-style interfaces for the post-post PC world.
Interesting, like
it's no accident that they made Google Now and that they made Siri the way that they made it because they were looking far beyond phones.
Apple should sue Google because they invented the card interface with HyperCard way back when. Who knows?
But you started, Leo.
Yeah, I'm in trouble now. Okay, now let's move on to iPhones. 4.7-inch phone, that's smaller than the existing iPhone 5S. And a 5.5-inch phone. You think both?
No. Right now it's 4 inches. 4.7 inches would be the size roughly of...
I thought a 5 was 5 inches. It's 4 inches?
4 inches.
Oh,
tiny little.
God, that's so small. How can you people use that?
We have hawk-like vision. No.
What was this? Wait a minute. So the 5 was 4 inches? So what was the 4S?
Before that, it was 3.5.
Holy cow, how did you use that?
It was almost a Palm Vier. It was almost Vier-sized.
And meanwhile... There, I see Jason Snell over here with his, 5.7-inch Galaxy S5 taking pictures. So really, Apple's going to move into the modern world with a 4.7-inch phone? That's my Moto X, and it's a perfect size, by the way. You can still hold it in the hand. It feels good.
if they stay with 4 inches, because a lot of people still do like 4-inch phones. Like if you look at the numbers of what sells, especially in the North American market, supersized phones have not done as well here as they've done in Asia. And Apple's done extremely well with 4-inch phones. So if they keep that around, even just to ease people out of them and go to 4 and 4.7, that makes a lot of sense for me. I've only heard about one bigger phone this year. I've not heard about two. That doesn't mean there's something bigger that's just not being called a phone or I'm not hearing about it or is for later in the year or next year. But I think to me, if you move the 5S, whether you call it a 5SE or whatever, down and you introduce the 4.7 one above that, that sounds like a smart lineup.
That might be what they do. And I have to say, I actually agree. The 4.7 is just right. I've been carrying, you know, this HTC One, and it's 5 inches. And when I go back and touch my Moto X, which is 4.7, I go, you know what? This is a better size. Mm-hmm. This is the right size. 4.7 is a good size.
Yeah. I mean, in any event, if Apple doesn't, I feel as though Apple has to do a larger screen phone at this point, to the degree that Apple has to do anything. But I think that I think it would be a mistake to ignore the popularity of these larger screen phones and stick with that form factor. It just if they are serious about the value of the iTunes content market, God, that's the iPhone is like the third or fourth device I would like to read a book on or watch a movie on at this point.
Right. It seems to me that there is a sweet spot. Maybe. I mean, everybody's different. Hand sizes are different and so forth. But it seems to me there is a sweet spot. And after going back and forth with littler and smaller and stuff, I have to say 4.7 feels like it's the sweet spot for everybody. Maybe I'm wrong.
I had the Nokia 1520 phone, which is so big that I
six inches.
It's a very nice phone, but I actually had to like make a purchase at the grocery store to prove a theory that it is exactly as big as 1.5 Pop-Tarts. That's how big this telephone is.
Pop-Tart and a halfer.
Now you can deduct the Pop-Tarts, Andy.
There you go. I don't care about deductions. I want sponsorship deals. I want to be on these podcasts with like a Pop-Tarts patch and a Victoria patch.
I'd like that.
But yeah, there is a sweet spot. I do think I did pull out my Moto X just like you, believe it or not, a few weeks ago to start like firing that up again and taking a look at it. And there's something about that size that it's larger than the iPhone to give a much more air to the user interface and also to content. It's not as overt as the HTC One, which is a brilliant phone. But there are times when you feel like, if you take this out in any environment, it's all about this is me and I'm using my mini tablet device. When sometimes you just want the discretion of a personal communication device.
We're going to take a break and come back with your picks of the week. So gentlemen, fire them up. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock is the place to go to get royalty-free images, vectors, and videos. And good Lord, do they have a huge selection. At last count, let's go down to the bottom of the page. I love this. 35,895,957 royalty-free stock images. 250,000 new images added this week. 250,000. And Shutterstock, I mean, these are high-quality images, almost all of them for professionals. Really good-looking, each of them curated for quality. Every time you visit, you'll find something new. So thank goodness they've got such a great search engine. At Shutterstock.com. Make an account. It's free to do so. You don't need to give them a credit card. Once you have an account, you can search to your heart's content and even add images to the light box. So I'm looking for watches, for instance. Here are some beautiful watches. And so you add them to your light box so you can just save them for later reference or to share them with a colleague. You can also take the noun, which is normally what you'd search for, and you can narrow it down. So they have if you want to refine your search, they have a great color picker that says, well, I only want blue watches or green watches or red watches. You can narrow it down by category. You can say, I only want photos or vectors or illustrations. I can even narrow it down by orientation, horizontal or vertical. I could exclude keywords. I mean, you could say only images with people, only images without people. I just, editorial or not, you can even say, look, I only want images with females, I love this, from 40 to 49 of African-American ethnicity, and there should be 3 people in the picture. Do you think I'm going to be able to do, will this result in anything? I don't know. Maybe I narrowed it down too much. Nope. So maybe if I take out, let's
remove
take...
watches.
Oh yeah. Well, no, watches is the search. Let's. I mean, I know all. If I. I mean, there you go. So here's three people pictures with watches. and women 40 to 49. That's bizarre. Wait a minute, they got a guy in there. Get him out of there. Oh, they got to have him in there because he's got the watch. It is fun to play with Shutterstock. If you create the light box, you know, create the account, you can do the light box, and then you can really play with it. Featured, if if you're a member, you get a, I think there's a free clip every week that you can take a look at. Now, when you decide to buy, you can buy individual clips or individual photos. You can buy a package, or you can do a subscription. That's what we do. The 25 image a day subscription, great for a blog or a publication. But let me ask you, if you decide to buy, to use our offer code, MacBreak 414 for April, 414, because MacBreak 414 will give you 20% off. I should sign in, but anyway, look at here's a picture of an iPhone with Facebook on the screen. Here's one with LinkedIn. Here's just an iPhone. If you're doing editorial work of any kind, you gotta have this thing. That looks like a Moto X. I love it. Just go over there, make that free account, and play with it a little bit. You'll see why we love it so much. Shutterstock.com. Use the offer code MacBreak414 when you buy to save 20%. Andy Inoko, I bet you have a pick of the week.
Yes, and this is a really great one, although this is going to be a little bit divisive. I think 90% of the people listening will say, oh, my God, that's such an incredible thing. I have no idea that that was possible. And 10% will be thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe that feature has been around for so long, and you're just hearing about it now. But, yes, I just heard about this now. If you look in the back of your cable box, your HD cable box, you will see a FireWire port there.
Yeah.
It looks like a FireWire port because it is a FireWire port.
Doesn't do anything.
Oh, yes, it does. There was in 2004, from 2004 afterward, makers of high def cable boxes are required to include a FireWire port that allows people to record TV shows in a digital format. This preserves the V8, like the VHS sort of functions of analog television, where you can just, if you want to record Dave and keep it, you can put a cassette in. So that's exactly what that port is, although the cable companies don't really want to tell you about that. So if you connect a FireWire cable to that and whatever sort of mojo you need to hook it up to your Thunderbolt thing, you can actually record anything that's going on your cable box there. This is last night's Letterman show, recorded, not converted from analog to digital, the pure 1080 HD digital screen. With no conversion whatsoever.
I do not think this is widely known at all.
And it works. There's also communication. So all you need is whatever cable that you need to get it done. And it cost me all of $35 to get the right adapter and a free app called Fire Record that hasn't been updated in several years, but it works. And what it does multiple things for you. The simplest thing that it does for you is you just, whatever's coming, whatever your cable box is playing, if it's an unprotected channel, it will just simply record whatever it's spitting out into an MPEG-2 file. It can also actually control your cable box. So you can actually tell it, please tune in to CBS at 11:35 p.m. and record for 1 hour and then stop recording and attach it to a file. And again,
now, it only does live, right? You can't take something you've DVR'd, or you can't.
No, again, this is the function of this is to make sure that people don't get cheated out of the normal functions of an analog VCR. So this morning, I asked myself the same question. If you have stuff that you've DVR'd, you can just simply start an instant recording, essentially just push the record button on this app, and then start playing something that you recorded like a month ago.
Sure.
And you can capture all of that then in full HD.
MPEG-2.
It's MPEG-2, so you need a VLC, the free video player, to play it. What I do instead is that I simply convert that file using Handbrake and convert it to just a basic MP4. And now you can use it in iTunes. You can sync it to your iPad. You can edit it. I really was interested in this because now that Letterman is on his way out and maybe Craig Ferguson too, I want to start recording shows that I don't want to lose.
He's on the block.
Yep. Well, without getting into a rat hole, he was turned. The CBS decided to, instead of making him the host of the Late Show, to pay him the millions of dollars that contractually he's obligated to get if he's not offered the Late Show. So that leaves a question of A, are they interested in keeping him as the host of 12:30, and or will Craig be interested in keeping on as the host of the 12:30 show? But yeah, but this is something I've been missing for years and years and years ever since the digital changeover, that sometimes there's a program you like so much you just want to keep it and be able to watch it again and again. And don't think that this is limited just to broadcast channels. I was recording it will depend on your cable lineup. Any channel that they have not scrambled or not put DRM on, it can record. So I recorded a DVR'd show from a month ago that I recorded off the Discovery Channel. National Geographic Channel recorded just fine. Unfortunately, I don't think it works with Turner Classic Movies on my cable lineup. But believe me, I'm about to systematically test every single channel.
So if it's encrypted, if it's a like HBO, you cannot do this.
Right. It will record an hour of stuff, but then it will not play because there'll be a mojo on the signal that says, oh, by the way, this is protected, yeah. So don't let this guy
I think that almost everything on my cable box, Comcast protects everything.
Well, it's broadcast channels are definitely not going to be locked because they're not allowed to lock up those channels. You're supposed to be able to just plug your cable. If you're subscribing to cable, you're supposed to be able to. If you have a cable in your house, you're supposed to be able to just plug that into the back of a TV with a digital tuner and be able to get your local broadcast channels. But as I found out and was a little bit surprised to find out with pleasure, there are plenty of commercial channels on your cable box that are at least on my system that are unlocked and fully recordable.
Wow.
I've got half of my DVR hard drive tied up with stuff that I want to keep, and some of that stuff's been on there for about a year waiting for me to I'm going to hook up my DVD recorder to the analog channels and just bake up a copy on it. And now I'm just going to, buying a hard drive to make sure I can keep these 10 hours, 20, 30 hours of HDTV. Wow. It is absolutely brilliant. It works just great. The worst thing that I can tell you is that once or twice, Fire Record has lost its connection to the cable box, in which case you quit, you relaunch, and it works just fine. It really is as simple as I'm making it sound.
Well, that makes a Mac Mini an even more. Well, now do they have FireWire on the current Mac?
I don't have FireWire on what I've got here. Again, a $30 FireWire to Thunderbolt adapter. Okay. All you need is another adapter cable that will convert the letter U shaped connector to the newer square type connector, and that's it. There's no
FireRecord has all of the scheduling features and everything that you'd want.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty basic. It looks like something that could easily be done with AppleScript Studio, as a matter of fact. I mean, as you can see, this really is the entire interface to it. Uh-huh. You could definitely set it up to record your favorite programs directly. I think it's simpler just to let your DVR do the job and then record off the ones that you want, unless you really do want to be an archivist and say, I really want every episode of Bob's Burgers digitally. In which case, you can certainly do that. The problem is, though, that if you are changing the channel while that thing is being recorded, then your recording will have changing the channel to The Amazing Race or changing the channel to 60 Minutes or whatever. So, but again, it works, it works, it works. And boy, do I feel dumb for not finding this out until last week.
Yeah. Now I can use my Mac Pro as a home theater PC.
Actually, you should buy a second one for that purpose, Leo.
The Apple rep I've been talking to listens to Mac Break Weekly. And he called after I complained last week. He said, no, really, we can look at your log. We'll know it's been rebooting. And I sent him the log. He said, yes. But he also said, now I, as part of the process, we ask you how you're using your Mac Pro. And are you still using it as a home theater PC? And I said, that was just a joke. I never meant to use it as a home theater PC. But now with Fire Record, maybe I will.
Lovely. I wish I knew about this when the Oscars was airing or the Grammys were airing or other things. But
Ron Swanson on your TV. That's a good one for me.
That's about as good as you get.
With a beard. Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week.
So Andy mentioned this actually earlier. It's an app called Screens VNC. It's made by Adovia, and they've just released version 3 of the Mac version of Screens. They'd done the iOS version redo a few months ago. It was really, really good. The Mac version is now out. I believe it costs $45 or $49. But what it is a VNC client. So it lets you share the screen of other computers, whether they're Windows computers or Mac computers or Linux computers. If you have that Mac Mini that you have in the closet or in the server room, you can access that. If you have a Linux box at the data center, you can access that. It's a very Mac-like experience. There's tons of really good VNC clients available for the Mac, but not all of them are very Mac-like. Very few of them are actually Mac-like. And Adobe has taken a lot of time and effort to make it. It's not an iOS 7 makeover. It's distinct from their iOS 7 apps, but it fits right in. It's sort of what I imagine maybe an Apple iOS 7 redesign for the Mac would be like. Just very clear, a lot of deference. There's not a lot of Chrome there, and what Chrome there is easily hidden. All you do is launch whatever computer you want to log into. You log into it. If you hold down the icon on the dock bar, it'll give you a list of recently launched computers so you can go instantly back to them. It's sort of like Apple's Back to the Mac if it worked really, really, really well. And I find myself using it all the time just to hook up to my podcasting machine to start a hangout if I'm in a different room, or you know, connecting to my mom's computer to help fix a couple things or change some settings. And if you get the Mac App Store version, which uses iCloud, it'll sync all of your remote computers via iCloud. And that means that everything you have on your iPhone and your iPad, you also have on your Mac. So you can do all the same things when you're out traveling with a device on LTE or Wi-Fi. And that just makes it a very nice solution for me.
By the way, I was not wrong. Comcast does, in fact, encrypt basic cable. I had an Elgato, and all of a sudden I couldn't use it anymore. And that's because in their infinite wisdom, my cable company encrypts everything. Maybe local TV is not encrypted. I'll have to try that, the live TV. But thank you, Comcast. Once again, the worst company in America. About to get a lot bigger.
Thank God.
Bigger and worser.
Yeah, bigger and worser. It just cracks me up when Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, says, "We're modeling our company on Apple." In what way exactly? You want to just the profits, basically, right?
Yes.
Because in no other way is Comcast anything like Apple. My tip of the week, maybe some of you will just throw up a little in your mouth when I mention it, is Office, Microsoft Office. They announced a very affordable personal subscription now for a single Mac plus one iPad, or I guess you could use it on Windows if you want, $6.99 a month for Office, which includes Word, Excel, PowerPoint, OneNote. And I think that I think it's $72 for a year, something like that. It's a very affordable way to get Office. You know, if you've ever gone to the store, I remember the last Office upgrade going, you know, Office, was it 2010 or something? I went to the store and it was like $800 for the box of Office. I just couldn't do it. I could not bring myself to write that check. $6.99 a month, not so bad. And it includes some cloud storage, Skype minutes, and so forth. So just announced today, I know most of you are very happy with other solutions for Office, but if you have to use Word for some reason or Excel, I'm glad that there is a very affordable way to do it.
It's an awesome deal.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I actually have the $10 small business one, and that gives me five computers, which is great. So, and that can be a heterogeneous mix of PCs and Macs. So I have some Windows and some Macs. They also promise that when they update Office for the Mac, which is probably in the next year, you'll get that automatically. Don't pay addition.
I'm glad that there's proving to be an actual upside to the subscription model, at least for Microsoft and Adobe customers, because it stinks to say that you're going to have to pay X dollars forever to get access to Photoshop. But at least they're saying, well, look, here's the free things. Here are ways that we're extending and enhancing it for you so that maybe you will be happy to be spending money every month for the rest of your life for the ability to edit photos.
Andy Iannacco, you are my man. My man. Andy
Dude.
That picture, by the way, that's been behind him again is Boulder, Colorado, in the beautiful Flatiron Mountains in Boulder. It is really pretty there. And I know that because my son goes to school there, and it's just gorgeous. Was it warming up a little bit when you were there?
God, I packed nothing but short sleeve shirts. It was like in the 60s and 70s. And then the day after I left, it was like they got snow. So
yeah,
welcome to Boulder. I've been going to this conference for 15 years. And for the first six of it, I had no idea how to pack for this a foot of snow one day and then 80 degrees the next day.
It's awesome. My son is a complete, native Californian, never saw snow once his whole life. But he's acclimated well. He's snowboarding and everything, loves it.
It could do with some more oxygen.
at
it's at altitude.
Feet,
it provokes a problem.
Yeah,
you were, but that's okay.
I'm You're huffing and puffing a little bit as I hike around town.
A lot of the sidewalks are very comfortable to sleep on.
Thank you, Andy. Always a pleasure. You can see his Anako's Almanac on 5x5.tv. Are you doing anything else you want to plug?
Epic Show 100 next week. Reviving old tech news so that you can hear an audiobook version of my tech writings for the Sun-Times and elsewhere. And pretty much that's it so far.
Where can we find old tech news?
It's also going to be on the 5x5 network. You will see it. I've recorded a show yesterday and another show is coming up on Thursday.
So you read your old columns.
It's sort of exactly. That's why I call it old tech news, because by the time you get it, it's probably about a week old.
Oh, it's not that old.
But so long as you know you put it out there, I think it's okay.
It's not like you're reading the 1983 version of the Anako.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. And it's a lot of fun because I like the. It seems to be the only way I can talk about a subject and make the show less than 30 minutes. If I've actually written out 1,500 words, I can simply read it back. So it's a lot of fun, and it satisfies my urge to do a compact one topic show as opposed to an Anako Almanac, which is what I think would make an interesting conversation today. And then you realize that that episode was 2 hours long. Perhaps we should have some sort of a bell attached to a timer to stop that from happening again. It was fun, but maybe it was more fun for me than to listen to.
Well, we'll look forward to episode 100 coming soon to 5x5.tv/IA. Renee Ritchie does his share of podcasts, too, for Mobile Nations. You can catch his work at imore.com. What's next? What's new on the iMore podcast?
This week's debug has Ken Ferry, who did the understudy for iPad app. But before that, he did auto layout and passbook for Apple. And especially if you just saw the Windows Phone 8.1 just launched and Microsoft is loading passbook into Microsoft Wallet. So if you're interested in that kind of drama or just how it works in general, you can check that show out.
Gosh, I'm looking at all the podcasts you guys do. It's amazing. Here I little old me. I thought I was the most prolific. I'm going to lose my crown any moment now.
We should form. Well, a
I don't
super
do all
group.
Of those.
A super group.
Yes.
Like ABBA plus the Living Beatles plus the Living Who.
Yeah. Super group. Thank you, Renee. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We do Mac Break Weekly Tuesday mornings, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1800 UTC Tuesday evenings. If you're in the UTZ time zone. On twit.tv. Please watch live. We'd love it if you're in the chat room and I can see your thoughts, your comments. But if you can't, on-demand versions of all of our shows are always available at our website, in this case, twit.tv/MBW, or wherever finer netcasts are aggregated, like iTunes and Instacast and the podcast client on your favorite device. Thank you for joining us. Now, my friends, I hate to say it, but time to get back to work, because break time is over.